Good morning. As perspectives on criminalizing homeless people continue to clash, today we'll get two views from the outside about Hawaii's homeless situation. This week, Honolulu is hosting visitors from two national efforts to end homelessness. We'll talk with the head of quality improvement for the 25 Cities campaign and the director of national initiatives at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. It's Tuesday, June 3rd from HPR2. It's The Conversation.
And later this hour, we'll turn our attention to kids, specifically how to explain the concept of war to children. It's the focus of this year's Children's Literature Conference. And a new project will bring a creative space for kids to Kaka'ako this fall. Today, we'll get a preview.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
Stay here for The Conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkuh. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
Some valuable perspectives on homelessness, huh?
Well, you know, we've had many conversations that we sort of loosely title The View from Over There.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when people come over here and bring a different perspective, it's worth paying attention. And today we're going to do that for at least the next 7 or 8 minutes. This morning, we're, of course, picking up the conversation about homelessness in Hawaii. The tension between city and county efforts and the initiatives of the state also play into federal work to end homelessness. In Honolulu, the pressure of tourism dollars to create a pretty picture for visitors is yet another pressure of what to do with people who are homeless instead of what to do for the homeless, as some in the community are suggesting are happening now. This week, Matthew Doherty is both a visitor to Hawaii and a representative of the federal government's Interagency Council on Homelessness. He's the director of national initiatives at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Nice to have you here. When you obviously are doing a great deal of traveling, how is it that you look at Hawaii?
When I look at Hawaii, I think it's on a path that many parts of the country are on, recognizing that the business as usual of how we've tried to address homelessness in our communities has not been effective, and that communities need to move forward with more effective, more efficient systems for getting people on paths out of homelessness. And ultimately, the solution to homelessness for every individual or family is finding the right permanent housing option with the right level of services to make sure that they can be successful and stable within that housing and begin to pursue their other goals. So there are communities in the country who have moved further down that path and are starting to demonstrate real progress towards ending homelessness. I think there's a lot of great conversation happening in Honolulu and Hawaii generally, but it is a little bit further back on the path and has some catching up to do in terms of moving towards the best practices that are demonstrating that they're successful in our country.
That sounds as if you are being terribly diplomatic.
No, I'm not being terrible. I'm actually optimistic about the conversations that are happening here. I know there's some conversations about criminalizing activities that are a distraction from the conversations that need to be happening about how do we actually create the systems, create the housing opportunities that we need. But those conversations are happening as well. So I'm really optimistic that this time coming here, about a year and a half after my first trip here, the dynamic, the conversations, the focus, the understanding of the practices the community needs to move to seems to be much more entrenched. And there's still work to do, but definitely on the right path.
As you say that we are moving down this path, albeit not as quickly as perhaps some other communities or not at the point at which they are, to move us even further, given what you have seen this trip and some of, as you say, the distraction of talking about criminalizing the homeless and the issue of what may be facing all of us as the city and councils is wrestling with this too, how do we get beyond that distraction and get back to where you think we should be?
Well, I think fundamentally the community needs to be talking about housing first, and I mean that in a lot of ways, that the housing first as a set of strategies for how to move people quickly from any experience of homelessness into permanent housing. And housing first for people experiencing chronic homelessness, we need to identify how we can get them into permanent supportive housing with comprehensive and intensive services as quickly as possible. For families who are experiencing homelessness, it's a similar path. Everything needs to be about housing first. How do we get people integrated back into their communities, settled into stable housing, able to be participating members of our community again? So I think that, and then I also mean housing first is that fundamentally the whole conversation needs to be about housing and how do we create those housing opportunities with the right services in place. And if the community can stay focused on talking about housing and talking about housing first, I think they can expedite their movement towards the right practices and the stronger system.
We think for quite a while now that we have been focusing on housing first and trying to get the most vulnerable people into real housing and not trying to put the shoe on the other foot by using services first and then housing is the bonus. And yet we've seen money sliced away from it, money not available to it. And now, the issue of, a real bricks and mortar initiative that may or may not happen because it's going to cost a lot of money as opposed to money that may go just for services. Are we talking and not really backing up talk with enough action?
Well, I think part of the understanding needs to be that the cost of doing nothing is not nothing, that the cost of the status quo is expensive for communities. And communities across the country have demonstrated that actually creating the housing opportunities costs the community and taxpayers less than the cost of when people are experiencing homelessness, the impact on our healthcare system, on the police response, on the justice system, that those costs are often invisible, but they actually are real costs that are dramatic and very expensive, and we can invest in the right solutions and actually save money and achieve better outcomes. So when we say that it's expensive, it's actually less expensive than what you are doing now, and that we need to move the resources into the more effective and more cost-efficient solutions.
Last week we talked about a recent survey in Orlando that seemed to bear out what you had to say just a moment ago. I'm sure you know that one,
yep.
Where the idea was 31,000 plus, if you keep somebody on the street, maybe a quarter of that if you were able to put them into housing.
Right, and there's studies from across the country. So I don't think Honolulu needs to repeat that study because every community that has implemented that kind of study has found the same findings, and it's consistent that there's always a dramatic reduction in the cost of ER visits, hospitalizations, crisis mental health response.
In
every community finds the
that.
Same, all of that. So I think we can safely assume that we've proven the case that it's more cost effective, and we don't need to spend time and money and resources debating whether it's going to be the same case here in Honolulu.
If all of that's so, why are we still debating the case?
I just think people need to understand the evidence, need to focus on the solutions, and need to change the conversation. And then if we keep talking about the impact of homelessness without talking about what the right solutions are, if we keep looking for just the quick and easy fix, we don't get to the real lasting solution. So I think, again, always talking about housing, that anytime you're having a conversation about homelessness, the primary topic should be what are the housing opportunities and how do we create more of those housing opportunities.
So if we're not having that conversation to the extent which we should, how do we change the conversation to get there?
Yep. Well, I think that conversation is happening. So part of the reason I'm here is part of a national initiative, the 25 Cities Initiative, that Oahu was invited to participate in, along with other major metropolitan areas across the country. And that conversation is, that effort is very much about how do we create the most efficient system for targeting and prioritizing people, identifying the people who are most vulnerable, who most need permanent supportive housing, or people who could be served through other models like rapid rehousing, less expensive, less intensive services. And really the community of providers has come together and is talking about how do they work as a system rather than as a set of programs and agencies. And that's the other important part of the conversation, is moving away from the idea that we have just sets of programs to that we have a system that's responding to the crisis of homelessness.
That's well integrated to be able to respond.
Right. And working across silos, across agency boundaries, and really understanding that they all have a role to play within a larger system of response.
Bottom line, when you look at all of this and say, okay, the cost of not doing it is obviously not nothing, what do you think that this is going to cost us? What do your numbers say?
I wouldn't be prepared this morning to give you a good estimate on that, so I'd have to dive further into the data. I have an understanding of the number of people experiencing homelessness and based upon the point in time count. I think the other part of the 25 cities effort is a real focus on doing an assessment and a standardized way of assessing people experiencing homelessness, and that's going to generate for the community much more detailed data to really understand the needs and the differences among, as you were referencing, the differences among the people experiencing homelessness here, and there's different responses that cost different amounts of money. So until we have that data to really understand the population better, I think we need to wait to make those kinds of cost projections.
And in getting that data, you just referenced something that we've been talking about a little bit over the last couple of weeks, of how do we have something that standardizes one sort of instrument that's standardized, so all of the answers can be compared appropriately and not have different agencies and different organizations using all kinds of different means of
gathering data. So the community providers are moving towards a standardized assessment tool, and they have a goal of doing 1,000 assessments in two regions of Oahu first. And that's going to be a wealth of data that I don't think the community will have ever had to really understand who the people within your community are who are experiencing homelessness, what are their needs, what are their challenges, and what are their goals and dreams for themselves. It should be just a terrific planning tool for really understanding how the community then needs to respond with the right housing and services options.
And a timeline for that?
I think the goal is about 100 days from now. They're aiming to have 1,000 of those assessments performed.
Which means this conversation will continue. Thanks so much.
Terrific. Thank you very
much. For being here today. Matthew Daugherty is the Director of National Initiatives at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. His agency bridges the work of the full council and states and communities. He leads the council's partnerships with other federal agencies and guides the work of regional coordinators. He's also responsible for implementing the federal strategic plan to prevent and end homelessness, the Opening Doors Initiative, in Arizona, California, Nevada, and Hawaii. He's been meeting with state and city officials this week.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're focusing on waterman Tom Blake. Blake was a champion swimmer, paddler, and avid surfer. He also was an inventor and innovator who made several major contributions to the sport of surfing. One of the most significant, was credited to him, was the creation of hollow surfboards. They were first produced in the late 1920s and early 1930s. These boards are made of wood, as were most boards at the time, but because of the hollow construction, they significantly reduced weight. This made surfing far more appealing to a wider range of people. Many had previously had difficulty carrying and are maneuvering the heavy boards. Along with designing the first hollow boards, Blake made another contribution to the sport of surfing in 1935. For today's quiz, can you tell us what that innovation was? Call us if you know at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 or listen for the answer later in the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm Dr. Mara Mulrooney from the Bishop Museum. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
War is one of humanity's absurdities, so how can it be presented to children in a way that makes sense? Human conflict and the reasons we enter into it are difficult enough for adults to understand. Up through the Second World War, arguably the last war that made any kind of sense, children's literature has had a patriotic slant, focusing on glory and heroism and downplaying the mindlessness of it all. But that is changing. Jill Dahlman will be talking about the way children's literature portrays war at Children's Literature Hawaii's 17th Biennial Conference, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Did the way war is portrayed for children change after the Second World War? Was that a turning point?
Yes, I believe it was. When we were talking about the golden age of comics, which is when children's comics really were for children, up to this point, I mean, even today when we hear the word comic book, we don't necessarily think of them as adult literature.
Mm-hmm.
However, that was because of its background, and it is arguably more for adults today than it is for children, unfortunately. But back in the golden age, it truly was for children. And there it was, there was more of a concentration on what could children do to help out the war effort, aside from something as simple as recycling. So heroes like Captain America came into play, and he developed, well, Captain America's creators developed the Sentinels of Liberty, where the children would go ahead and look for spies or look for unusual activity, and they actually were quite successful at doing it. And then now the representation isn't quite there when in terms of a patriotic slant. When you take a look at authors such as Linda Sue Park, when she writes her books, When My Name Was Kyoko, for example, she talks about the Japanese occupation of Korea and what had happened in one child's experience. And obviously, Linda C. Park went through a tremendous amount of research in order to go ahead and be able to write, not just in a child's voice, but to write accurately and with facts properly presented.
Well, Jill, that's an enormous coming of age from Sergeant Rock and Black Hawk Rangers and Everybody Who Goes to War as a Hero, right?
That's correct. And nobody ever got hurt over there. Nobody ever died.
Yeah.
Nothing bad ever happened.
Right.
And the superheroes were there to save us, to make certain that we would be victorious. There are no superheroes in today's novels. Arguably one of the best graphic novels, A Mouse, which was written by Art Spiegelman and won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
Spiegelman's representation of what happened during the Holocaust, which is both simultaneously an autobiography of himself and a biography of his father's experience in the concentration camps, does not sugarcoat anything. It was a day that it demonstrates the day-to-day struggle to stay alive. And this is actually used anywhere from sixth grade curriculum up until college curriculum.
That was a huge turning point in the so-called, that's when we stopped calling them comic books and started calling them graphic novels in a big way.
Well, that's when graphic novels actually were honored as an accepted form of literary genre.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it took a little bit of work in order to get that far. But in the late 60s, early 70s, they started calling it graphic novel. And so that's when it really started to turn around, and that's when the graphic novel actually became more for an adult audience than it did for a children's audience.
Well, Jill, the late 60s and early 70s, as far as war is concerned and our perception of it is concerned, were kind of the death of illusion, in a sense. So that's Vietnam era. It was pretty hard to hang on to heroic illusions after Vietnam, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And Captain America even demonstrated that. Captain America did not participate in the Vietnam War, which to me speaks volumes. If this is America's best superhero that we've got, and he's not going to war, he's tackling home front problems. That, to me, suggests that it's not necessarily an anti-war statement, but it certainly is not a pro-war statement. And this is at a time when it's my president, good or bad, and you accept my president. You know, they don't really, they're not flawless, but by the same token, you don't point out their flaws. Right? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Captain America also had a, I'm not sure how to call it. He went ahead and discovered Watergate in one of the graphic novels, and one of the representations was that he realized that his country was not the country he had been fighting for all these years, and so he just pretty much took off to find the real America on a motorcycle.
So that was a Watergate era Marvel comic where he actually they brought Watergate into the subject matter.
They did, but they didn't. They just changed the names ever so slightly, but you knew who they were talking about.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
And then when the curtain is revealed, when the curtain is drawn back, and you see the figure of the president there, it looks oddly enough like Richard Nixon.
Well, he was a bit of a cartoon villain even without the cartoons, but
yeah, he had that kind of face.
But you know, the Second World War certainly seems cut and dried heroes and villains mm-hmm. in ways that subsequent wars have not. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And especially like going back to that golden age again, the golden age of comics, the enemy was represented in very animalistic views. I mean, the way that they drew the enemy, the Japanese had fangs,
yeah.
And their skin was not exactly a normal color. It was more of a funky green.
Yeah.
Anything to demonize the enemy, to make the enemy the other, so that it would be easier to kill. It's easy to kill something that's a demon and scary looking, but when it looks like your next door neighbor, not quite so much.
That's how you send young men to war. That's the process that's gone on since the Romans, since who knows when, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to. Otherwise, you're shooting your neighbor, and that doesn't make sense to people. So that's the reason why if you don't demonize them, then who is there to hate and who is there to perpetuate that anger?
And I think in military training, the thing is to get rid of hesitation that you might
mm-hmm.
have, right? So
don't think, just do.
Yeah.
Right.
But we're now seeing a lot more ambiguities are now being allowed in, Joe. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I believe so. I believe that there's more of an emphasis on the individual and not on let us exterminate a race. It's more of a, hey, wait a minute, there's some atrocities going on. We need to call attention to those atrocities in a way that children can understand. So if it's written, say, for example, if I go back to my Linda Sue Parks example of when my name was Kyoko, the child is maybe 8, 9 years old, and she sees the Japanese come in. She hears them change her name from her Korean name to a Japanese name, which is where the title of the book came from. And the child, as the child reads this book, they will experience the same thing she did, the way that they tried to get rid of the Rose of Sharon bushes because it was the Korean national bush, and what her family did to hide their particular Rose of Sharon bush, which was her mother's pride and joy.
Well, Jill, it's amazing that medium can take on something so complex, but I appreciate getting the chance to talk to you this morning.
So please feel free to come out and see some of the other amazing authors and illustrators at our conference on Friday and Saturday.
We'll send them your way. Jill Dahlman is a professor of literature at the University of Hawaii, Hilo. She'll be talking about children's literature and the ways it has evolved over the years this weekend at Children's Literature Hawaii's 17th Biennial Conference. It's at Chaminade University in Honolulu, and you can find out more about it at hpr2.org.
Ordering up economic prosperity, but hold the carbon, please.
Climate change that's fueled by carbon pollution is supercharging risks, not just to our health, but to our communities, to our economy, and to our way of life.
The EPA wants a 30% reduction in carbon. Industry reaction next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More and more station members are choosing sustaining membership as their preferred method of support. Thank you to Sarita Ray of Kailua, Elizabeth Dingledon of Kamuela, and Bruce Makarowitz of Kailua Kona for helping HPR plan for the future. Sustaining membership is an easy installment program, just $5 a month or whatever you choose, and it continues until you tell us otherwise. If you'd like to know more, you can contact the membership team at 955-8821 or log on to hpr2.org and visit the support page. Well, after a long meeting, the UH Board of Regents made its selection yesterday, and you've no doubt heard the choice. That's leading many to ask, was there any doubt? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Maybe it was yesterday's reality check. You know, there was a lot of controversy surrounding this as the process was going forward, and we heard about that quite recently. But looking at the outcome and looking at the votes that led to that outcome, it seems in some ways as if this were a foregone conclusion.
There's 15 regents total, and overwhelmingly 11 votes, two-thirds margin, voted in favor of David Lastner, the current interim, although I guess you could take the word interim off that title now. He is the new UH president. Only two people voted for the retired Army General, Frank Wierzynski. And there were actually two abstentions. Regents right. Jeff Portnoy and Jeff Aceto said, you know, the process was flawed, and there was even a move to reopen the whole thing again, but most regents felt, no, we've got our guy. Let's get this thing over with.
Wasn't part of the issue, too, that the idea of reopening the process might be construed as damaging to the university?
It is. I mean, it's already been damaging to the university in terms of what has happened with prior presidents. There have been at least two I can think of, including Marcy Greenwood, who left under cloudy circumstances, shall we say.
And Dobell, too.
Evan Dobell, exactly. And Lastner has been on the job almost a year now. It's been since September that he's been serving in an interim capacity. He knows the job. He wants to make UH a model for sustainability, 21st century technology, and those sorts of things. I think another priority is he wants Hawaii students to feel comfortable choosing UH rather than going somewhere else, like a school on the mainland.
Well, and we've heard that line before. You know, a lot of people would like kids to see UH as being a viable alternative to leaving. But is there something that you see in the selection process and as this happened that perhaps we didn't pay attention to?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a couple of things definitely are noticeably different. Lastner will be paid $100,000 less than his predecessor, $375,000. It's also not a long-term contract, unlike what has been extended to previous presidents. So the regents appear to be going into this cautiously to perhaps, I hate to say it, they may have another opportunity in only a few years from now to go through this whole process again.
Well, I mean, looking at that and saying, well, maybe that's just being prudent given everything that we've experienced over the last 10, 15 years.
Quite possibly. And the bad PR is the thing I think most people do not want to go on any further because it is, in fact, damaging both to the university and, frankly, to the state of Hawaii.
All right. We're going to let it go at that and see where we go from here. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com. Continuing our conversation now about homeless in Hawaii. State and city efforts sometimes run in tandem. Sometimes they seem to run afoul of each other, especially where Waikiki and tourism dollars are concerned. You may remember that we talked about that yesterday in the Reality Check segment. Both Honolulu City and County initiatives to help homeless people seem to agree that the key is housing. They would agree with state officials who say that housing is also key. Oahu is participating in the National 25 Cities 100,000 Homes Campaign. And although the 100,000 Homes Campaign nationally will end in July, locally, the mission will end in September 30th with the goal of finding and housing the 100 most vulnerable homeless residents on Oahu. This week, it's getting some help from Beth Sander. She's the National Director of Quality Improvement. And she joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You've made several trips to Hawaii. This is not certainly your first look at us. But as you look at where we are now and where we are in the campaign, where do we stack up relative to all the cities that you visit in that 25-city campaign?
So I first started coming to Honolulu to work with the providers and the leadership here about 6 to 9 months ago. And I have to say the leap forward that the community has made in that short period of time and really looking at how to invest in a coordinated system that's focused on prioritizing the most chronic and vulnerable for permanent housing has been really amazing, and I think actually positions Honolulu in a very good place against the 25 cities nationally. It's the direction that everyone is going to really look at how housing resources can be leveraged to end homelessness. And I think Honolulu is starting on that track and is very aligned with where major urban cities across the country are going.
When we spoke earlier in the hour with Matthew Doherty, he made the comment that all of the attention that's going to the issue of criminalizing the homeless is really a distraction from what we should be talking about, which is back to housing and really getting back to that very basic necessity.
Yeah, I think the conversation, so I've had the privilege of being here the last couple of days and reading the conversation happening in the paper about quote-unquote solutions that relate to criminalizing homeless or moving them on from sidewalks or ordinance street sleeping ordinances. And I'll just be honest that those are approaches that do not end homelessness and are a distraction for the community for the types of interventions that will actually lead to less people sleeping on the street. And I think we, you know, in the sector across the country, that has been proven out again and again by communities who did pass similar ordinances and really saw no shift in the end result of are there now less people homeless than there were before we passed that ordinance, because it has nothing to do with housing. And so my strong advice to the community is to really take the energy that's being focused on that conversation and focus it on where are the housing resources that are sustainable and long-term and that can be integrated into a coordinated system that focus on getting people straight off the street and into permanent housing as quickly as possible.
We've been frustrated by the fact that we don't have enough places to put people, and that's certainly not unique to Hawaii.
No.
Other places have it, but we still have a very small land mass and people who say, well, I'm not sure I really want to have this near my neighborhood, in my neighborhood. We're still back to the bricks and mortar question of where are we going to put people?
Yeah, I think that it's an issue that lots of communities struggle with. Places like San Francisco that have a very, very low vacancy rate, that's always an issue. What we've seen, though, is it's not a reason not to make progress, that there is a lot of existing resources in your community that can be looked at and leveraged, and that's something that could start tomorrow, where the city can really look at across all the housing and services resources that we have at our disposal, what's available to leverage, what can we repurpose to really focus on housing the most vulnerable and chronic in our community, and ultimately getting to zero on homelessness. We've seen communities like Los Angeles dedicate, you know, 4,000 units of housing that are set aside for this population. So there's plenty of evidence of working at the city, county, or state level to dedicate specific resources that help to move the needle within the existing pot of resources that already exist. There's likely to be a gap, but it's hard to make the case for more resources when you're currently not maximizing what you have.
So how do you see us not maximizing what we have? You spoke of something that we could do tomorrow. What would that be?
So I think one of the great assets that you have in your community is that you have a governor, state interagency council, a mayor who are really committed to this idea of ending homelessness. I think what's missing is the resource match in a sustainable way. I think one of the best things that could happen in this community is that the city council could vote to bring the service and the housing resources to the table. That would be a big leap forward, but those resources need to be sustainable year on year, every year. There's also existing housing resources that are controlled by the city and state through the public housing authorities that could be leveraged right now for the benefit of moving people off the street and into permanent housing. But again, those can't be year-long solutions. They need to be an investment in a sustainable system that can benefit the community long-term.
Are we looking too short-term?
Yeah, funding that is 1 year funding for services or housing is a great first step. But really, what happens after that year is that people are still need housing and support. And so really looking at long term, how are our resources supporting an end to homelessness? And Matthew talked about the cost issue. Again, there's no excuse for the conversation that this is more costly, because it's just simply not. What you're doing now by leaving people on the street and shifting them around from place to place or moving their belongings is costing you a lot more money than it would cost to look at existing resources and how they can be leveraged and look at how to bring new resources from the state or from the city into play.
But all of that seems to be where you think we should focus without the distractions, which, as we talked about earlier, go back to criminalizing the homeless or not naming the homeless appropriately and thinking that they are coming from out of state or they're this group or that group, not having real data to do that. Don't we need to have that data first?
Yeah, I think you don't need to have that. I mean, you have enough information right now about your community to get started. And certainly the goal in the next 100 days, and actually what many of the provider community have already been working on, is a common way to assess, as you mentioned before, individuals on the sewer sleep in the street and in shelter, to really understand the match between the need of that individual and the right type of housing intervention, so that the community isn't over-resourcing or under-resourcing the match of those two things together. But that doesn't, you don't have to wait to get all those assessments done to start. That right now there's, you know, 350 assessments have been done of people. We can start today moving people into housing. But the providers and the leaders that we're meeting with over the next 2 days can build an elegant, efficient system for housing people and moving people quickly off the street. But if there aren't any resources on the back end to move people into, then it's not going to be successful. So that investment needs to be there.
That almost sounds like the words of tennis legend Arthur Ashe: start where you are, do what you can.
Use what you have. Yeah,
right. And that's what you're telling us is basically don't make excuses. Just go do something and move along the path.
And do something that is actually going to end people's homelessness. I think that, again, there's just evidence after evidence around focusing on housing as the solution is actually the thing that's going to, every business leader in Waikiki, every community member in Honolulu wants to see less people sleeping on the street, because economically it's the right thing, morally it's the right thing, and that is possible. And against the federal goals to end homelessness, we have 31 months to end chronic and veterans homelessness. I have a lot of confidence that Honolulu can do that.
Beth Zander, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Beth Zander is the Director of Quality Improvement for the 100,000 Homes Campaign. It's an initiative of Community Solutions. She leads the quality improvement efforts, supporting communities involved in the project. Specifically, she's been helping those cities to improve the speed and process for housing the most vulnerable homeless individuals from streets and shelters. She's been in Honolulu this week to meet with state and city officials. Now we're going to get back to today's quiz. Waterman Tom Blake was the subject of this morning's backyard quiz, and if you're unfamiliar with his name, he was a champion swimmer, paddler, and avid surfer. He was also an inventor, an innovator, who made several major contributions to the sport of surfing. One of the most significant, credited to his name, is the creation of hollow surfboards. They were first revealed in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Those surfboards were made of wood, like most boards of the time, but because of the hollow construction, weight was significantly reduced. It made it a lot easier for people to carry and to use them. Along with designing those first hollow surfboards, Blake made another innovation in the sport. That was in the year 1935. For today's quiz, we wanted you to name that major innovation. Here's the story. He attached a stabilizing fin, a.k.a. a skeg, to the tail of his surfboard. That original prototype was, in actuality, a 4-inch deep by 1-foot long keel that was scavenged from an old speedboat. The addition of the fin allowed surfers to ride on tighter angles across waves while still maintaining stability, and it went on to become a crucial design element on most surfboards. So that's the innovation, and that's today's answer to the quiz at 847. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Suprabhatam, mera naam Ved Prakash Nanda hai. Main Denver se hoon. और आप यहाँ HPR2 की कन्वर्सेशन सुन रहे हैं। ये एक मेंबर सपोर्टेड हवाई पब्लिक रेडियो है।
Back to English. There are a number of efforts underway around the state to harness the creativity of children, and if it's done right, a great deal of energy can be unleashed. Hadley Nunes is the director of the Present Project, an interactive children's workshop space that will get underway in Kaka'ako this fall. There's a preview event this weekend. Hadley is here to tell us what she has planned. Good morning, Hadley.
Hi, good morning.
Getting children into the arts has an enormous potential because they've got so much to offer, yeah?
Yeah, and I think that it's an exciting place to effect a change in a long-term sense. You know, the world really that we're preparing kids for is one that we don't yet know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think using art as a starting point for kids to learn, you know, how to collaborate, how to be flexible, improvise, that all those things, you know, are what will come into play as they kind of take the world into their own hands.
One of the things that you've learned as an artist in different disciplines is the importance of discipline, that you have to train, you have to acquire some skills, you have to do things you don't necessarily feel like doing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that process is becoming comfortable with failure, even, you
yeah,
know,
sure.
The kind of mistakes, and that's part of the process of really discovering something new. And that's part of why this project is so exciting to me, because it's set within the context of a residency. So an artist residency is a place where artists come. They're provided with materials, housing, time, and space so that they can explore, you know, what they're interested in. And in this particular project, they're also going to be collaborating with one another. So I think it's an exciting place for kids to experience the authenticity of the creative process and kind of go through that trial and error, the experiments, refining and taking risks, you know, alongside professional artists that are engaged in that process themselves.
One of the things about the tricky things, I would think, about teaching kids about art is sort of knowing when to get out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's so exciting. We have an education partner coming from New York City. His name is Brian Welch, and he's created a learning design center in New York City. And his philosophy really fascinated me once we kind of started talking about the potential of him getting involved in the project, in that, you know, artists, professional artists, you know, are going to be working, you know, to, you know, they're going to be in the process. And so students have the opportunity to, you know, kind of work alongside them and discover their own pathway through the processes that they're sort of observing. So it takes the learning process back before the Industrial Revolution, when it became, you know, mechanized, when it became, there's an answer, raise your hand and give the right answer.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes more about sort of, well, what is your solution? You know, maybe there's a, you know, a canoe being built, and the children start picking up the, you know, the chips of wood and design, you know, like some kind of mask, and then they start playing this, you know, character. There's all these ways that kids will kind of flip things on their heads if you, like you said, step back and let them kind of go with it.
And the world in which they are going to be making art, say 10, 15, 20 years down the road, is one we can't necessarily predict, and therefore we can't predict what kind of art they're going to be making.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of what's been also inspiring with connecting with the Danny Calacchini Foundation and their, you know, initiative to connect, you know, young musicians with art through Powwow, which has been enormously successful. It was so inspiring to see that project, the music school, take shape in Lana Lane Studios, where I have a studio space. They would meet every day, and they'd be working on these songs, and it was just, it was amazing. So, you know, I think making the connection through this project provides students with an opportunity to be exposed to a whole different set of vocabulary, you know, so that we're kind of giving kids this sort of opportunity to take the reins of what we have as professionals here at our fingertips and create something new, like you said, for the future.
In your education as an artist, you changed fields. You trained in dance and then moved into visual arts, which tells me that you had a certain amount of confidence that you were going to be able to make art that was worth making, right? No matter what the métier was. I mean, that's a big change from dance to the visual.
Well, yes, but it was interesting because the company that I was a part of, it was called Moving Theater, based in New York City, was so much fun to be a part of because there were opera singers, you know, New York City ballet dancers. We had visual artists, writers. There was this whole combination of people that came together to create these pieces. And so I think kind of working within that context, you know, gave me the sense that sort of, you know, I could move through any form, any medium, and kind of combine it to, because I was already working in that way.
Yeah.
And I think when I transitioned to graduate school and I was focusing on drawing and painting, I think now, you know, coming sort of full circle and wanting to, again, sort of find that interdisciplinary mix and mashup that was so inspiring at that time, you know, but in this context involving kids, which I think is also very different than my experience in New York City, where artists become focused on their own conversation and education and arts is a totally separate arena. Whereas in Hawaii, you know, we're really trying to integrate, you know, all different kinds of pieces into a whole instead of just talking about us, you know, one certain conversation that can be understood, you know, among a certain group of people.
Well, what stood out to me about your arts education was that you never lost that sense of possibility, that you were going somewhere good. And that seems to me the thing that you're going to be passing along with this workshop, yeah? I mean, just no matter which way you go, I mean, you clearly something was done right in your arts education because nothing stopped you, right?
Yeah, and I think that flexibility is so important because we get rigid, you know, we become rigid, you know, as we start to perfect something and we identify, we define ourselves and say, oh, I'm this, I'm that, you know, and I think it's so refreshing when we just kind of step back and say, well, what if I want to change? What if I want to do something different?
Yeah.
And kind of letting yourself go into that territory where you have the instincts to seek, search.
Experiment. I think that's very refreshing, Hadley, and it's really good to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Hadley Nunes is the director and curator of the Present Project. It's an interactive children's workshop space and installation that will get underway this September. There's a preview event Monday, June 9th from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Lana Lane Studios in Kaka'ako, and you can find out more at hpr2.org.
The 2014 Hoku Award winner Jeff Peterson returns to the stage of the Palikou Theater when HPR presents Jeff Peterson and Friends Hana Ho. Join Jeff with special guest Raiatea Helm on August 3rd for an afternoon of Hawaiian music on Oahu's windward side. Ticket pre-sale to HPR members at 955-8821 or online at hprtickets.org.
Homelessness very much wrapped up in today's show, and we'll keep talking about that. It's an issue that's been haunting us for so many years, and the question really is, what will we be able to do to, if not end it, because that may not be practical and that may not be something that can actually happen in reality, but what can we do to substantially reduce it and really help those most vulnerable people?
Yeah, you have the task of reducing the root causes, which is a whole other task. But these are some very practical solutions in the air.
Which is, logically, get somebody into stable housing first.
You bet.
That's what we keep hearing. We'll see what happens in reality. Coming up tomorrow in our reality, we're going to be going off to Kauai and broadcasting from two islands. I'll be over there. Chris will be over here. And from over there on Kauai, we'll be talking about that proposal to develop houses in a small resort at the former Club Med property in Princeville.
And he'll take a visit to a children's ocean camp on Maui.
You can talk to us anytime you like on Facebook, on Twitter. You can go to the website and find out more about that. You can email us, too, at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows, links to more information, lots of other good things are archived on our website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back tomorrow morning from two islands with you for more of The Conversation. Have a good day.